It's time for Capital Thinking, where we analyze the key policy, political, legal, and business issues that will shape America's future. Live from Washington, D.C., this is your unfiltered tour of the halls of power. Now, here's your host, Kevin O'Neill.
All right. Good afternoon, everyone. We have a terrific show for you today. We're going to talk a lot about President Obama's penultimate State of the Union address from earlier this week. We have joining us two of my new colleagues from Squire Patton Boggs, folks who have an intimate understanding of the inner workings of Capitol Hill, who can share some of their opinions with us. First, Dave Schnitker, who spent 21 years working in the House of Representatives and 15 years as a close advisor to the Speaker of the House, John Boehner from Ohio. You can follow Schnitker at his on Twitter at O-Schnitt, which is the closest we're going to come on the Internet to say something inappropriate today. That's O-Schnitt, O-H-S-C-H-N-I-T-T. He's always got a provocative handle on Twitter on the events of the day. Also joining us is my new colleague, Congressman Jim Matheson, who formerly represented the state of Utah, served several terms, most notably as the Democrat who represented the most Republican district held by any Democrat in the House of Representatives. He served as a chief deputy whip for the House Democrats and served several terms on the Influential Energy and Commerce Committee, where he oversaw much of the nation's economic activity. So two guys with great opinions about the news of the day from the State of the Union. Let's start at the 50,000-foot level. Congressman, this is your party. This is your president. So give us your thoughts and your grades on the president's performance the other night.
Well, first of all, in terms of performance, setting aside what people may think about policies if they agree or disagree, I thought it was one of the better speeches he's given. I think he was more relaxed. He was more in a comfort zone, it seemed. And I thought that that was one of his better State of the Union speeches in that regard. It's a tough speech to give. You know, you walk in, and after every sentence, it seems like someone wants to interrupt with applause. And so it's hard to get in a good rhythm or cadence as you're giving that speech. But I thought the president actually, as I said, compared to his previous State of the Union addresses, seemed quite relaxed. And I thought he did a good job.
It is hard to go home and take out the trash after giving a speech where after every line, 400 people stand up and applaud you. So, Dave, let's go for the reaction from the congressional Republicans who were not the people who stood and applauded every line.
Well, Kevin, it's good to be with you. Thanks for having us on, and hopefully the FCC doesn't shut us down after you uttering my Twitter handle on the air. I would agree with Congressman Matheson in terms of presentation. The president certainly looked and sounded comfortable the other night. I do think there are a number of important things that the president and the new Congress can work together on in the year ahead. But frankly, I think those things are going to end up being the focus in spite of the content of the speech the president gave two nights ago, and not because of it. I mean, I think that there was quite a bit of disappointment, particularly on the Republican side of the aisle among my former staff colleagues and the members they represent in some of the policy content of the speech. I think it was Jim Garrity of National Review that put it best. It was an hour and 10 minutes of, here's what I would do if I had a Democratic House and Senate, which, of course, the president doesn't have. He's got a Republican-controlled Senate for the first time in his presidency and a larger majority in the House from Republicans than the president has had during his presidency. So I think there was a sense on our side of the aisle that the president ought to have given an address that spoke to those realities and proposed a way forward that emphasized a way forward reflecting those realities.
So, Congressman, let's come back to you and let's pick that point up, because you were known as one of the ultimate pragmatists in the House of Representatives. What did you hear in that speech that you could cling to and say, these are the things that can get done across party lines in this Congress this year?
Well, first of all, I would like to have heard more. I think that the public, whatever they classify themselves, Democrat, Republican, Independent, I think a lot of people in this country are looking for a more pragmatic consensus-building approach in terms of their elected officials in Washington. And I think they're thirsty for it. In fact, they want it. I think there's some issues where there are opportunities for folks to come together, and I think the president highlighted one, and that's trade. and opening these. There's some significant trade agreements, one with the Atlantic region of our country, primarily Europe, and also the Pacific Rim, the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement. The president needs authority from Congress to negotiate those. Every president for the last 40 years has had that type of authority to negotiate a trade agreement. Interestingly enough, there's bipartisan support and bipartisan opposition within Congress to giving the president that. So this is not an issue that falls on party lines. I personally, on my own politics, think that open trade agreements are a good thing for our economy. But if I was to predict an issue where there really is an opportunity for this Congress to come together in a bipartisan way, this is it. And there's a deadline where it kind of needs to happen. So if you ask me what I'm clinging to is opportunities for progress, that's the number one issue I thought that came out of the speech, where there really is going to be, I believe, in both the House and the Senate, a real effort to try to move trade promotion authority.
So, Dave, analyze that for us. There is bipartisan support and opposition. How does the Speaker work with the President to get something like that done?
Well, I would certainly agree with Congressman Matheson. There's this notion that nothing gets done or very little gets done in divided government. But if you look at the trade issue, it actually took a change in the majority in the House in 2011 to get major free trade agreements done with South Korea, Colombia, Panama. Those agreements had been sort of sitting in the wings for years, but were not ratified, turned into law, until there was a change in majorities, and the president actually worked with congressional leaders to make those things happen. And I do think you'll see a similar dynamic in play this year on trade promotion authority. But what it's really going to come down to is how hard the president, frankly, works the issue. That, you know, this is a situation where the president needs to challenge his own party to deliver the votes. The Republican leadership in the House and Senate will have some chores as well on that front. But I think, by and large, the GOP is free trade oriented and remains free trade oriented. And you're going to see the White House need to engage directly on the issue. The president has a tradition of when he wants something out of Congress, he'll take his case to the American people, as all presidents do. Use the bully pulpit, leave Washington. You have the roadshow, where you're doing campaign style events that are essentially designed to put pressure on Congress to do the will of the president. And I think one test of the president's seriousness about getting this done will be whether do we see the roadshow from the president, where he leaves Washington, takes the case to the American people, makes the case for trade promotion authority and the subsequent benefits that will come from it.
Well, I know he's on the road today. He's at the University of Kansas speaking about some of his initiatives on part of that roadshow. Let's stay in the T's under topics, if you will. We talked about trade. I heard two other big T conversations in the State of the Union, and that was transportation and also tax. Let's start with infrastructure development. And Jim, what did you hear there that you liked about the president's remarks, and how viable is that?
Well, I like the fact, first of all, he highlighted investment in transportation infrastructure because, number one, it needs to happen in this country. And number two, again, I think there's a dynamic in Congress right now in a bipartisan way where there is an opportunity to make something happen here. This isn't going to be easy. I don't want to sugarcoat this, but I think there's a recognition that Congress has failed to enact long-term transportation policy for a number of years now, and that doesn't help anybody if you don't have a long-term policy in place, because infrastructure projects require long lead times, and you really need that certainty of policy. So I think there is a willingness and an interest on both the Republican and Democratic side of the aisle to move ahead with a significant transportation bill. As I said, the president highlighted in his speech, even though he spoke for over an hour, you can't mention every issue that's a priority. So it's important that was mentioned, and I think there's broad public support for investment in that kind of infrastructure.
So, Dave, he talked about it, but he very carefully tiptoed around two phrases, user fee and gas tax, which are at the heart of the transportation debate.
Well, as one might expect in the State of the Union address, that's exactly what happened. But you're absolutely right. I mean, for years we've funded infrastructure projects on a short-term basis, which is fine for some projects, but totally inadequate for many others. There's one in Cincinnati, my hometown, The Brent Spence Bridge, which actually bridges Ohio and Kentucky, that's needed to be replaced for many years. Of course, Cincinnati is where the site of there was a tragic infrastructure accident just this week on I-75, where an overpass collapsed and a construction worker was tragically killed. That's the type of the Brent Spence Bridge is the type of project that can only be replaced on a long-term basis with a long-term funding stream. So a short-term reauthorization of transportation projects that doesn't really cut it. So that the challenge is there. The trick, as we said, is where do you get the revenue to finance some of these things long-term? There's also the challenge that congressional leaders will face, and that in the past you would have passed a long-term infrastructure bill aided by what's called earmarks or pork barrel projects, and that those have been banned. So leadership no longer has that tool available to win votes to pass things like that. But I think there is hope that it can be done. Also, there was a major water products major water projects bill enacted in the last Congress that many believe will serve as a model for how you could do a long-term infrastructure and transportation bill in the current Congress. So hopefully we do see this as an area of cooperation in the year.
Well, that's two areas of agreement that we see. That's trade and transportation. I think we're going to take a quick break. We'll come back and talk about that third area, tax, and what you think of the president's tax proposals. And I think we're also going to get into some of your favorite memories from sitting in that room and listening to the State of the Union in person. We want to get your perspective and also some thoughts on some of the what maybe some of the other political leaders we're thinking. But we'll take a quick break. We'll be back with more Capital Thinking in just a moment.
Now you don't have to stay linked to your desktop or laptop. Take Voice America on the go and listen anywhere. Get our mobile app for iPhone, BlackBerry, or Android at the Apple iTunes App Store, BlackBerry App World, or Android Market.
The United States faces a moral crisis that strikes at the very heart of our democracy. Americans who live in our nation's capital have no representation in Congress. Like American citizens in the 50 states, they pay federal taxes, fight and die in wars. But when our heroes come home, they are stripped of a basic political right that most of us take for granted. They have no voice in our national legislature. D.C. deserves equal representation in Congress. Go to dcvote.org to learn how you can help end this injustice.
The following is a paid advertisement from Squire Patton Boggs, LLP. Need to keep up to date with regulatory matters? Looking to expand your business globally? We've got enviable connections in D.C., Brussels, and beyond, with commercially focused teams to advise on the current and future legislation that you need to know about. With 44 offices in 21 countries located in major global cities, we can make that happen. Squire Patton Boggs, the global law firm providing business insight at the point where law, business, and policy meet. To find out how we can help you, visit SquirePattonBoggs.com. Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Squire Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You can contact us at 202-457-6000.
The following is a paid advertisement from Squire Patton Boggs, LLP. Let us make sure your voice is heard. We have been helping clients for more than 50 years as the leading U.S. law firm for public policy and lobbying. Our team and our connections give you an unmatched ability to meet your public policy objectives, whatever the size or focus of your organization. Squire Patton Boggs, the global law firm providing business insight at the point where law, business, and policy meet. To find out how we can help you, visit SquirePattonBoggs.com. Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Squire Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You can contact us at 202-457-6000.
Now you don't have to stay linked to your desktop or laptop. Take Voice America on the go and listen anywhere. Get our mobile app for iPhone, BlackBerry, or Android at the Apple iTunes App Store, BlackBerry App World, or Android Market.
Live from Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattenboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattenboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right. Welcome back to the show. So we're talking about the President's State of the Union Address. We're joined by two of my new colleagues, Dave Schnitker, the former Deputy Chief of Staff for House Speaker John Boehner, and Congressman Jim Matheson, who represented the state of Utah and served on the Energy and Commerce Committee. They both recently joined the firm as of the start of the year, and they're talking about the highs and lows of the State of the Union Address. So we had talked transportation and trade. Let's talk tax. I'll start with you, Dave. I was fascinated by Paul Ryan, chairman of the Ways and Means Committee, his appearances on Fox and MSNBC the night of the State of the Union and after were very conciliatory towards the president, talking more about the places they could work together than about the divisions he saw in the speech.
Well, I think that was by design on Chairman Ryan's part, and frankly, I think that it probably would have been better if the White House had approached the speech a little differently and taken a similar tack right from the beginning. You saw in the days ahead of the State of the Union, the ramp-up period, as we call it, you can always tell what the White House wants to be the takeaway item from the speech by what they leak ahead of time. And what they were leaking were not nuggets about the potential for bipartisan cooperation on an overhaul of the tax code. What they were leaking were the policy proposals for tax increases that the president was highlighting, and which frankly, I think even most in the White House probably know stand no chance of passing through Congress in its current form, and probably wouldn't have passed the Congress back when it was controlled entirely by Democrats in the 111th Congress. So, but all that said, I do think that there is true potential for at least a start on an overhaul of the tax code, the entire tax code. It's something the president has spoken of his interest in doing and the need to do. The Speaker and Leader McConnell have also indicated that that's an area of great potential, and I do think you'll see a large commitment to at least beginning the process of crafting a proposal and moving it in the months ahead on both sides.
So, Jim, let me turn to you, your perspective on the president's tax initiatives. That one thing, you know, my wife listens and she sends me an urgent email. Hey, the president wants to take away the 529 accounts for the kids. You know, that's there, he giveth and he taketh away in many of those proposals.
Yeah, I think that, the devil's in the details always, and when you're talking about overhauling the tax code, it's a monumental task. It's incredibly complicated. There's all kinds of components to the tax code. I think the president kind of made a mistake by trying to talk about too many specifics, because you can't talk about enough of them anyway. You got to look at his whole package, and I wish he would have addressed the tax reform issue in the broader sense of, look, we all know our tax code is messed up now. It's antiquated. It has a lot of inequities built into it. It doesn't match a 21st century global economy. And I'm for tax reform. Here are my broad-based ideas about how we should do it, where there really is, at least at that up, you know, 100,000-foot level, there really is a lot of agreement. I don't know if you remember during the last presidential campaign, but on corporate tax reform, Romney and Obama were basically saying the same thing about we need to lower rates, and we need to close various expenditures and create a broader, flatter base for our tax code. That's the premise that I wish he would have led off with in the State of the Union and really stuck with that. I don't want to overstate how it's difficult to overstate how hard it's going to be to do real tax reform, by the way. This is a huge undertaking, but for the sake of our country, I hope there is going to be more of a concerted effort. So I think the fact that Paul Ryan took an approach that was not throwing bombs, office, but was actually saying, look, I want to sit down and roll my sleeves and try to work with everybody to get this done. I appreciate that because it's the only way we're going to move forward on tax reform.
So you mentioned the 21st century economy, and what was notable about the speech was it's very significant when you're a company and you get a shout out in the State of the Union. And when you look back at what companies got a shout out, it was the companies that you had jurisdiction over in the Energy and Commerce Committee, the Facebooks, the Googles, the Teslas, sort of the sexy technology companies. That seemed very deliberate, and I wonder what that tells us about the president's policy intentions for the next 2 years.
Well, clearly indicates that these are clearly companies on the rise, and they're also companies that have a brand awareness. I mean, throughout our country, everybody knows who Google is. You know, it's no big surprise. It's interesting because I think those companies recognize that the policy world is, for good or for bad, when policy gets made in Washington, it has an impact, and you're better off being at the table trying to contribute your thoughts and ideas and information to help shape that policy. That was a mistake that I think a lot of the tech industry made back in the 90s, going into the first part of the century. They didn't engage with the policy world at all.
Microsoft learned that very painfully.
Yeah, Microsoft's a great example, and I always say you're better off being at the table than leaving policy happening in a vacuum where you're not part of it. And so I appreciate the fact the president brought up those industries. I'd like to think that, again, if you're talking about broader economic policy, you don't want to get too industry specific, but there's no question where it comes to U.S. growth, innovation, and opportunity to compete in the world, these are the types of the companies that are going to lead the way for this country.
So, Dave, let's bring it back to you. Very interesting because the companies mentioned come from a sector that's generally perceived to tilt very strongly to the left in their political giving, and yet Republicans have a strategy, it seems like, to reach out and explain why those companies' interests overlap with their political philosophy. So talk a little bit about, again, how you see that intersecting in what Republicans hope to do in this Congress.
Well, I think you're right. That is the perception, but I think it's also true that perception is beginning to change. You're seeing, in fact, I think there's an article in Politico just this morning about the level of engagement by some of the very companies that the president mentioned and others, Apple, for one, who, as Congressman Matheson said, initially kept Washington at an arm's length, and that might be a polite way of saying it, but now recognize the need for and benefits that can come from total engagement with the policy shaping process in Washington, and you're seeing that happen all over town. And these are companies that really are, in many ways, helping to drive the U.S. economy today and creating jobs. And for them to align themselves really with one party over another, it doesn't work to the advantage of their objectives or their workers. So, they're full participants in the political process at this point, and I think that's a good thing.
And if I could just jump in also, one thing about I think clearly you'll have individuals or CEOs of certain companies that may be out there with their political leanings well known, but I tend to find that most people in the business world are remarkably pragmatic, and they're really not into this ideological polarization going on in Washington. They're just looking for what is the best way to position their business to succeed, to grow in terms of revenues and job creation, and they're going to go and look for allies on either side of the aisle that have that agenda. And so I think that's something we should always remember in terms of when we look at the business community writ large, is that there's really a pragmatic component to the way most folks in that community approach policy. And boy, anything that brings pragmatic components to policymaking in Washington, I think that's a good thing.
So this was really the first State of the Union that the president's a lame duck for, and we've kicked off the 2016 presidential season. I was quick to note that Hillary Clinton came out with some tweets that were strongly supportive of the State of the Union address. But I want each of you to talk about how the candidates in both parties could pivot from the State of the Union address to advance their own agendas. Where do their interests overlap? If they can help the president, where do their interests best served by hindering the president or congressional objectives in the next 2 years? And we'll start with the 800-pound gorilla on the Democratic side and Hillary Clinton.
Well, I think that this would apply, quite frankly, to folks on either the Democratic or Republican side looking at president. But I think you want to be offering constructive solutions about how to move forward. My sense in terms of where the public has been, in terms of the low approval ratings that Congress has had over the last few years, those low approval ratings are out of a sense of frustration of, can't you guys just work together to get something done? And so if any prospective candidate, in this case you asked me about Hillary Clinton, can offer a path forward, and that may mean disagreeing with President Obama on how he's handling something, or disagreeing with Congress, Democrats or Republicans, if they're pursuing ideas that don't provide a path forward, and she can provide an alternative that does. I think that's how you distinguish yourself if you want to run for president in 2016. And as I said, that advice probably applies across the board.
Dave, you can choose either to tell us how Hillary's boxed in or what openings have been provided to the vast Republican field.
Well, I do, unfortunately, have to say, I think some of the messaging the president was doing in the State of the Union was not aimed at the legislative year ahead in Congress, but rather aimed at maybe shaping things for the 2016 election. President Obama won't be on the ballot, but let's face it, he would like to ensure that whoever the Democratic nominee ends up being gets elected, and gets elected for what they'd like to call the third Obama term. So that's I think that might explain some of the messaging in the speech on items that we all know aren't going anywhere through this current Congress. But in terms of 2016, I just pick up on what Jim said. I think the electorate is showing a clear hunger right now for governing, for solutions. I think it's going to be an election, at least the general election, one in which competence is a major issue. And in an electoral environment of that sort, it tends to be governors and ex-governors who tend to have a leg up on the competition, because they've actually served as chief executives of their states. They've made decisions that are not dissimilar from the decisions that presidents have to make on a daily basis. And my sense is that, at least on the Republican side, you're likely to see a number of our either current governors or ex-governors get into the race and run strongly, and that one of them will end up being the last person standing at the end of the day because of the appeal of competence and governing in that election format.
I noticed the Republicans, in choosing the respondent, chose a female senator, somebody who wasn't in a position to leverage this for the 2016 election, because previously they've had a lot of former senators, presidential candidates, Marco Rubio, Bobby Jindal, Governor McDonnell before he was indicted and was shipped off to the big house. But let me shift themes and talk about, both of you have had a unique opportunity among Americans. You were in Congress for 14 years. Dave, you were a senior advisor, deputy chief of staff to the Speaker of the House for many years. And so you've stood in that room, a place most Americans can never dream about. Tell us a little bit about what the feeling is when the President of the United States walks into the well of the House of Representatives, what it's like to listen, maybe something funny that's happened. Congressman, tell us your story there.
Well, there's no question that it is a remarkably powerful experience. I know it's cliche, but there is electricity in the air. And I've been there in my time in Congress. I overlap with President Bush and President Obama, and in either case, either president giving a State of the Union address. It's just remarkably exciting to be in that room. You know, when you grow up and you're a kid and you watch it on TV and you see him walk down that aisle, and then to be in that room and that's happening is an exceptional experience, and it never got old for me. It was always the sort of thing that was really exciting. I'm not going to lie to you. Sometimes the speeches got a little long, but to be there in terms of the pomp and circumstance of the moment is really something. And you know, it's something that I wish it was more of a State of the Union address. That's the one thing I wish. I don't know when we got into this this pattern where we had to have a Republican or an alternative party response to the president, where it's a partisan thing. I'd like to see we get back to where it's the whole country coming together to talk about the State of the Union. But nonetheless, I can just share with you, it's a remarkable experience and real privilege for me to have been on the floor.
Dave, real quick favorite memory from that?
Well, Kevin, I'm glad you asked about what it was like to have stood in that room, because as a staffer, when I was in the chamber for the speech, that's exactly what I did the entire time. There aren't seats for staffers during the State of the Union if you're lucky enough to be there at all. But again, it's an unprecedented event in our government. And when I would give tours of the Capitol, that's the one thing that always stops people. You point to the doors that the president walks through at the beginning of that process, and the sergeant at arms announces, "Mr. Speaker, the president." It means something to every American.
Well, that's a good place for us to wrap up. We're going to come back and talk technology issues right after this break.
Become our friend on Facebook. Post your thoughts about our shows and network on our timeline. Visit facebook.com/Voice America.
The following is a paid advertisement from Squire Patton Boggs, LLP. We are much more than just a public policy and lobbying firm. We are a leading international legal practice that excels in the areas where government, law, and business meet. We understand countries, cultures, and how business works across the globe. We use our expertise to deliver tailored solutions to the individual challenges our clients face, when and where they need them. Squire Patton Boggs, the global law firm providing business insight at the point where law, business, and policy meet. To find out how we can help you, visit SquirePattonBoggs.com. Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Squire Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You can contact us at 202-457-6000.
The United States faces a moral crisis that strikes at the very heart of our democracy. Americans who live in our nation's capital have no representation in Congress. Like American citizens in the 50 states, they pay federal taxes, fight and die in wars. But when our heroes come home, they are stripped of a basic political right that most of us take for granted. They have no voice in our national legislature. D.C. deserves equal representation in Congress. Go to dcvote.org to learn how you can help end this injustice.
The following is a paid advertisement from Squire Patton Boggs, LLP. Let us make sure your voice is heard. We have been helping clients for more than 50 years as the leading U.S. law firm for public policy and lobbying. Our team and our connections give you an unmatched ability to meet your public policy objectives, whatever the size or focus of your organization. Squire Patton Boggs, the global law firm providing business insight at the point where law, business, and policy meet. To find out how we can help you, visit SquirePattonBoggs.com. Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Squire Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You can contact us at 202-457-6000.
Stay up to date on the latest news out of Washington affecting your business. Check out Patton Boggs' new Capital Thinking blog at capitalthinking.pattonboggs.com. Let one of the world's best legal and political intelligence networks keep you in the loop on the policy developments that matter to you most. Access the network today at capitalthinking.pattonboggs.com. That's capitalthinking.pattonboggs.com.
Become our friend on Facebook. Post your thoughts about our shows and network on our timeline. Visit facebook.com/Voice America.
From Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now,
back to Capital Thinking.
All right, welcome back to the show. I'm joined by one of my favorite people at the firm. Despite his Georgetown pedigree, I'm a Syracuse guy. It's basketball season, so we're at each other's throat. But we're joined by Paul Bozzozzi, one of the leaders of the firm's technology practice in the public policy space. And he's going to tell us a little bit about some new decisions coming out of the FCC. And Paul, to start, I know we talked a few months ago. Seemed like the weather was a lot nicer, so maybe it was summer, about a big E-rate decision out of the FCC, and now it looks like we've got something else related. What's happening that we're starting to see multiple decisions here, and what's the interplay between them?
Well, in July, the commission shifted the program support away from legacy telephone voice services towards broadband, and it indicated that it would focus $1 billion over the next two funding years in 2015 and 16 for broadband in the classroom. But it left unfinished business as to the future funding of the program for these and other initiatives. Remember, that was prior to the election, and asked for comments on that and some other issues. Well, the election passed, and as was predicted in July by Commissioner Pye, it came true in December when the commission came back and increased the program funding cap by $1.5 billion. So starting in funding year 2015, the cap is now $3.9 billion. There was some logic to this since the cap, first set in 1998, had only been adjusted for inflation since 2010.
All right, so maybe let's get into the substance of the differences between what came out in the summer and what's just come out this week.
Well, in July, the focus was about the availability of access to high-speed broadband in the classroom itself. It was a concern that although school buildings had connectivity to high-speed broadband, that connectivity was not being delivered into the classrooms themselves via, for example, Wi-Fi capacity. So students were not able to make full use of devices, PEDs, or smartphones. Again, to fund the $1 billion for 2015 and 2016, the commission did not increase the cap, but started a process for removing support for legacy voice services like paging, cell phones for bus drivers, and asked the USAC to identify the extent of funds held in reserve that could be carried forward. Now, in December, that decision is focused more on those school buildings that still do not have high-speed connectivity to the school building itself. Many of these are in rural areas. Obviously, if you don't have it, connectivity to the building, you can't get it to the classroom, even if you install in the classroom the necessary facilities. So July in the classroom, December to the school building.
So you talk about a pretty big increase in funding here, roughly $1.5 billion overall, taking it from $2.4 billion to $3.9 billion. That's a lot of extra change to find in the seat cushion. So where are the feds, where's the FCC coming up with $1.5 billion in new money?
Well, it's most likely to come up with that money from you and I.
I don't have that kind of debt.
Well, we as consumers, we make payments on our phone bill through something called the Universal Service Fund charge. That's a charge that's imposed on certain telecom and other services provided by the carriers, and is generally then passed on to consumers on the phone bills, as I said. It supports the E-rate program and the three other universal service programs. So the FCC chairman estimated that the added charge would be up to 16 cents per month, less than $2 a year, if all $1.5 billion of this increase were needed. Remember, schools and libraries have to apply for this and justify their use. This seems like a pretty paltry sum. But the two Republican members of the commission, Ajit Pai and Mike O'Reilly, still opposed the increase in the cap as they had in July. But that's where the principal funding will come from, consumers.
And in terms of program support, are we looking at further increases going forward?
Well, I don't think there'll be any further increases in the cap. Remember, the cap is an amount up to which support can be given, but there are funds held in reserve by USAC to deal with pending appeal matters, to deal with the fact that some schools, although they get a designated amount of support, don't necessarily always use all of that support during the funding year. So those funds can be carried forward to supplement the annual amount that is available for the program. And in fact, the FCC the fall asked USAC to look back at their cash management practices to see what, if any, funding could be brought forward. And they just a couple of weeks ago went back to the FCC and said, lo and behold, we have now found another $1.75 billion in funds that can be carried forward. So that's going to also supplement, even if the cap is not increased further.
So we focused on a couple things in these rulings, but I know that there's more sort of embedded there. Walk us through some of the other decisions that were made in the recent ruling.
Well, the principal one, again, relating to the lifting of the cap, but there had been in the July order, a tweaking in the definition of rural versus urban schools, and rural schools get a bigger break under the program, and the change in this definition caused a lot of consternation in the educational community, particularly since some schools that formerly had been classified as rural were now slipping into the urban category. So the commission...
suburban, there's no middle ground?
No, there's no middle ground. And so the commission went back and kind of fixed that to take effect in this funding year. There were some other changes that they made regarding support for a certain kind of fiber capacity and obligations of entities receiving support under another USF program to support broadband connectivity. But those don't take effect until funding year 2016, which will start in July 1 of 2016.
Well, you mentioned in one of your earlier answers that a couple Republican commissioners on the FCC objected to that decision to raise I think you said 16 cents a month out of my cell phone bill. So did they object overall? I mean, or is the FCC together on all of these issues?
Well, I think there's a clear togetherness on the need to reform the program, enhance support for broadband. There's not a clear togetherness on the idea of this supplemental funding. When this issue was raised in July, a lot of educational organizations pressed to have this done in July. The Republicans made it very clear that they were opposed to it then. And they remained opposed to it even with the 16 cents. In fact, I think it was Commissioner High who somehow projected that this was a 17% tax increase. I don't know how he made that calculation, but they're very much opposed to it. The educational community, obviously, was very much in favor of increasing the cap and doing some of these other things that they did in the order. And so were generally the participants in the program, although to the extent that voice services are now being phased out in terms of support, there was an attempt to get that decision reversed by some of the carriers, but didn't go anywhere.
So I've got about 2 minutes left, Paul. Tell me a little bit about, overall, as you counsel clients, what do these changes mean? If you're somebody who wants to get in the program, what do you need to know and worry about as you go forward in 2015?
Well, although there are efforts to simplify the process, to some degree, what the commission did added a degree of complexity to the program. So you have to understand these new rules. You have to understand the new application requirements. And absent an attention to detail, you run the risk of non-compliance. And there continues to be on the part of USAC and the commission a great deal of vigilance to appropriate and proper use of program funding. There's a lot of auditing that is going on. So any school or school district that is participating in this, unless they have appropriate internal or external compliance advice, should be getting it to make sure they understand, starting in 2015, how they can take advantage of these new opportunities and how they can do so in a fashion that doesn't have them run afoul of the Commission's policies and rules on things like competitive bidding and gifts to service providers and other elements of the rules.
Paul, why don't you hit everybody with your email address if they want more information from you?
My email address is paul.bezozzi, that's paul.bezozzi, at squirepb.com.
Well, we're going to stay in the technology area. When we come back from the break, we're going to talk a little bit more about consumer privacy. You're listening to Capital Thinking.
Become our friend on Facebook. Post your thoughts about our shows and network on our timeline. Visit facebook.com/Voice America.
The following is a paid advertisement from Squire Patton Boggs, LLP. Let us make sure your voice is heard. We have been helping clients for more than 50 years as the leading U.S. law firm for public policy and lobbying. Our team and our connections give you an unmatched ability to meet your public policy objectives, whatever the size or focus of your organization. Squire Patton Boggs, the global law firm providing business insight at the point where law, business, and policy meet. To find out how we can help you, visit squirepattonboggs.com. Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Squire Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You can contact us at 202-457-6000.
Stay up to date on the latest news out of Washington affecting your business. Check out Patton Boggs' new Capital Thinking blog at capitalthinking.pattonboggs.com. Let one of the world's best legal and political intelligence networks keep you in the loop on the policy developments that matter to you most. Access the network today at capitalthinking.pattonboggs.com. That's capitalthinking.pattonboggs.com.
The United States faces a moral crisis that strikes at the very heart of our democracy. Americans who live in our nation's capital have no representation in Congress. Like American citizens in the 50 states, they pay federal taxes, fight and die in wars. But when our heroes come home, they are stripped of a basic political right that most of us take for granted. They have no voice in our national legislature. D.C. deserves equal representation in Congress. Go to dcvote.org to learn how you can help end this injustice.
The following is a paid advertisement from Squire Patton Boggs, LLP. We are much more than just a public policy and lobbying firm. We are a leading international legal practice that excels in the areas where government, law, and business meet. We understand countries, cultures, and how business works across the globe. We use our expertise to deliver tailored solutions to the individual challenges our clients face, when and where they need them. Squire Patton Boggs, the global law firm providing business insight at the point where law, business, and policy meet. To find out how we can help you, visit squirepattonboggs.com. Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Squire Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You can contact us at 202-457-6000.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network. From Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right, welcome
Welcome back. We are continuing our discussion of the President's State of the Union address. We're joined by one of our most frequent and favorite contributors, Deborah Lodge, who's our privacy expert. Deborah, I heard a lot about privacy in the State of the Union address. What did the President have to say, and what's it mean?
Hi, Kevin. I'm delighted to be here again. Thank you for asking me. And yes, privacy was a central issue that came up in the President's State of the Union address. It was very interesting because it mentioned several privacy-related points. One, the need to meet the threat of cyber attacks. Second, the need to combat identity theft. And third, the need to protect student data. And a week before the State of the Union address, President Obama gave a speech at the Federal Trade Commission, which, you know, as you know, is the federal agency that has done an awfully lot of enforcement in the privacy area. And at that speech, he really pre-shadowed what he was going to speak about in the State of the Union address and what's going to happen. And a key issue is that the White House released, a draft of what's called the Personal Data Notification and Protection Act. And this is significant because, believe it or not, we have no federal data breach notification law. Virtually every state has a data breach notification law. But, you know, companies, and most companies are interstate, companies that deal, you know, nationwide have to comply then with this patchwork of differing state requirements when there's a targeted breach. And, you know, as we all know, there have been many retailer breaches and other breaches. Target, of course, had an awful one a little over a year ago, and there have been several more recently. So, you know, this is a big deal. It's big news that there's now federal legislation proposed by the White House on this.
So I know a lot of these past legislative efforts have fizzled out, and there's a lot of controversy about some of these bills and what it means. So walk us through some of the details of why these things are controversial and what's in some of these packages.
Sure. Well, you know, yes, as ever, the devil is in the detail. And, you know, as you mentioned, you know, for many years before, there have been efforts to pass a federal bill, and they've all fizzled out. And some of the controversies relate to, you know, federal-state laws and the, you know, federal-state balance of powers. And several state laws are very specific and very powerful. And indeed, just last week, New York Attorney General Eric Schneiderman said that he is significantly trying to strengthen the New York data breach. So that's one issue is, you know, where is the balance of power? And then, of course, turning to the provisions of the federal law, one of the key issues is, will it preempt the state laws or not? Or will, as some other privacy-related federal legislation does, will it only, you know, set a federal standard and allow the states to increase the requirements, increase the protection levels? So that's another big issue. And this current White House proposal says that the federal law supersedes state law. Well, that's an interesting choice of words, too. And there's going to be a lot of debate about, well, what does that mean? Does it supersede? Although there's one savings clause, which is that if the state provides under its law some victim protection assistance, then that will continue in force. So that's really an issue.
So, Deborah, typically the President's State of the Union address is either preceded immediately before or immediately after by some legislative efforts. So is there something pending, or is there something that's going to come out as a result of what he said at the State of the Union on the legislative front?
Yeah, well, I think that the White House proposal is likely to be introduced into Congress. And indeed, last week, the day after the FTC speech, but before the State of the Union address, Senator Bill Nelson introduced the Data Security and Breach Notification Act, which he said mirrors the White House proposal, but it wasn't available from the GPO yet, so we haven't been able to really, you know, parse it through. And also, the House Subcommittee on Commerce, Manufacturing, and Trade, which is chaired by Representative Representative Burgess, anyway, scheduled a hearing on January 27th on what are the elements of a strong data protection bill. So clearly, you know, there's going to be additional, movement on that.
I think you're talking about Michael Burgess from the Dallas area, right? He's the
chair of
that subcommittee. So I know you said you haven't seen all of that bill. Are you able to give us a sense of the highlights?
Yeah, well, one I mentioned is preemption, and a second is what is the issue about, when does the notification have to be given? What are the safe harbors? There's a safe harbor here if the data is encrypted, so it can't be used by a third party. Another highlight is the power given to the Federal Trade Commission, which will have authority, of course, over companies within its jurisdiction, but also now companies that fall technically outside of the FTC jurisdiction, such as companies that are primarily regulated by the FCC or the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. And that's a novelty, I think, that's going to be controversial. So there's a lot more detail. And I know I only have two more minutes, so I do want to mention the student privacy bill, which was also featured in the State of the Union address. And we do think that there will be additional action on that. And the president has said that he is, planning to adopt possibly federally some of the protections that California has adopted for student privacy to make sure that student data can't be used for marketing purposes.
That's going to do it for now. Deborah.Lodge at Squire PB if you want more info. We'll be back next week with another great edition of Capital Thinking.
Thank you for joining us for Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. We hope to have you join us again for more insight from Washington. We're here every Thursday at 9 a.m. Pacific Time, noon Eastern, on the Voice America Business Network.